Hello and welcome to the Mindcore Podcast. I'm Diana Sparks and I'm here with my friend, confidant, and co-host, Enrique Recuero.
Thank you for tuning in. If this is your first time listening to the Mindcore Podcast is dedicated to the idea of universal free thought.
What's that?
Those are the ideas and the values of the academy or the university, kind of in a classical sense that the person should try to be strong through their intellect and to be powerful in society through their intellect. We see ourselves as a podcast of radical educators for radical educators.
Rock on.
Whee! Today on our show, we're having our guest is pop culture guru, officially labeled thus, Robert Weiner. He's an expert on Mystery Science Theater 3000, Captain America, Fringe Cinema, and The Grateful Dead. We're really, really into pop culture here on the podcast. We're all into movies, video games, comic books, graphic novels, role-playing games. And we've decided that our show needed to have its own resident pop culture guru. And we'd like to introduce the newest member of our team, Reverend Grimes.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Certainly not anywhere near as advanced of the guru level as your guest today, but can certainly bring some perspective to the nerdier topics that I hear you guys go on about every week.
So let's start by defining pop culture and why is it actually important real quickly, real briefly for people who might not be totally aware.
I'm more inclined to think of examples in a good working definition. Comic books always come to mind, action movies, things like Star Wars, even music, bands like Kiss.
Isn't that for the unwashed masses, though?
Well, yeah, well, that's what we're all about. We're all about the the unwashed masses.
Okay, well, I would like to ask if you're about the unwashed masses, just if you could kind of hone in on your mission statement here a little bit, because you talk about the values and the ideas of academia. You know, it may be an obvious question, but do I have to be involved in academia to, you know, really care at all what you're saying?
No. The whole point is that none of us are currently involved in academia, either Diana or Reverend Grimes or I. And we just think that being smart and pushing yourself forward and being well-informed and being engaged is a better life and it's better for society. Going back to our question about pop culture, you know, I think that those things that might be seen as lowbrow really are not, because we know because of guys like Rob that they're well actually studied, respected, and they have a big voice within the academy. It's really people in the sandwich, like between the people, like basically you've got people who are into that stuff naturally and enthusiastic about it and care about it and think about it, and then you have people who are like that who have degrees in it. And then you have all the other assholes who don't know about it.
Yeah, I kind of imagine that some pop culture is like, and I think this is kind of the old school, very snotty view, is that it's kind of like putting a dog pill in a hot dog. Mm-hmm. Like you're putting that seed of intellectualism or enlightened worldview into a easily digestible package that maybe less sophisticated people can understand, but I think that view is utter fallacy.
Well, of course it's fallacy, because, I mean, if you look at the pop culture itself, if you look at the phrasing, you're talking about, you know, something that's popular, something that's for the masses, and to look down on something just because doing it is pop in one way or another seems ridiculous when you realize that, you know, you can go back to the plays of Shakespeare, and those were created for the masses. They were pop culture of the time. And suddenly now, you know, well, not suddenly, but, you know, they're certainly worth studying. I think the key and the challenge is to see what's worth looking at that's coming out right now.
Yeah, and that's a good, like, good for posterity kind of argument, too. Like, we look at Shakespeare because the common things about it, the things that made it popular, give us a glimpse into that Elizabethan culture. At least that's one way to look at Shakespeare. But I think what we want to really try to focus on is the practical application now of pop culture events that are happening now. And why would we want to do that?
I got my education. I have a degree. I have a neuroscience degree, which, you know, hopefully impresses some of you.
That impresses me.
I'm really impressed.
We're both impressed sitting here. I think everybody else is, too.
But I learned more from reading comic books that were kind of more underground, adult-oriented comic books, like the DC Vertigo line. It primarily had a big influence on me, especially with Sandman and writers like Matt Wagner, Frank Miller. Role-playing games, you know, Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game, which was popular in the 90s that I grew up playing when I was a teenager. I was a goth teenager that wanted to be a vampire and wore eyeliner and smoked clothes and played vampire.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's an entire generation that grew up that way, and it's popular enough that I believe something like a week, 2 weeks ago, they just went to press on the 20th anniversary edition of this book that you're talking about, you know, of this game. I mean, it obviously, you know, it has endured. It has lasted.
Well, I don't think it affected an entire generation. Certainly a sect of an entire generation that people love to look down on, but where that is somewhat ignorant, I think, is if you just look at True Blood. That's, you know, we've had deep intellectual arguments about whether or not it's plagiarized from the role of World of Darkness role-playing games.
But what I was wanting to point out about these games is that they always began every section with a quote. And these quotes would be, you know, everything from, like, Goethe to Machiavelli to, like, you know, Abby Hoffman. So I would read this shit in the game, and then I would go look it up. And since it was the 90s and the internet sucked, where did I go look shit up?
Where'd you go look shit up?
I can't even imagine.
The library!
Oh my goodness.
The physical location known as the public library.
Whoop!
And that's another aspect of our show today, because one of Rob's biggest contributions is not only that he is an expert in all these things, but he basically, he's a librarian, and every library he's worked at, he's made a model for free distribution of really good, high-quality pop culture content.
Okay, so what would you say are some examples of this type of free media that he's making available, and why is that important?
Well, he has a very comprehensive... There to be a big comprehensive collection of graphic novels that's organized in the way it would be in the comic book story, and full of what we're calling fringe material. I was able to get Alan Moore's Promethea there the other day, just kind of on a hunch. And I've been to libraries all over the country, man, and that's not something I would expect in a normal library. But even libraries that don't have Rob's collection, I would still advocate them as being totally awesome. The other thing is that he just brings in stuff, like weird movies, documentaries.
Okay, why is it important to have those? To have those weird movies, to have those documentaries, to have these sort of fringe elements available for free to just regular guys like you and me. Why is that important?
Well, because hopefully we'll make cool shit out of it. We'll be more informed. It will allow us to reach our own potential. We'll be better human beings. And the key thing, again, I mean, I can't harp on this enough, is that it's free. The internet has made everything, so many things so accessible that I can get an introduction to just about anything I want. But to go really in depth, you know, on some subjects, the internet is really limited.
No substitute for actual research,
yeah.
In other words.
Well, and even with all this pop culture stuff, you know, there's plenty of things that I've found that I was interested in that are pop culture stuff, like bands or books.
Absolutely. There's three books that I'm reading right now that I actually obtained from the library. That are all scholarly treatments of various forms of pop culture.
Or even stuff that's so rare that it may not be online yet. If you can get that kind of stuff in a library collection, I think you're doing truly a good thing and a powerful civic duty.
Yeah, and the reason that it's a powerful civic duty is because then you're not only appealing to collectors or people that, you know, have the funds to follow that information. You're giving that knowledge away for free. And so that way there's... Because even just having the internet gives you an economic foot up.
Yeah.
Especially with finding jobs and things like that. So there are some really down and dirty, practical uses for the library that make it the benevolent social institution that it is.
That's true. I did a thing, as you guys know, but to share with the audience, where I went and basically bummed around like the whole Western United States penniless for a few months. I went and did anarchist stuff in Santa Cruz, California, and kind of just wanted to check it out. And I had a lot of friends who were hitchhikers and hobos. And I blogged chronically with no laptop, no computer to my name, just taking advantage of the library system. It really made it possible for me to stay connected, even though I was doing this really weird thing that I could have gotten lost in very, very easily.
Yeah, and I think I cannot believe that this is not just something that you teach children as a normal subject. And perhaps it will be soon, because I think it'll be vital to our survival, but there is got to be some kind of research literacy taught, or research fluency, maybe the technical term that the librarians like to call it. But basically, you need a guide. There's so much information so readily accessible now through the internet primarily, but also through interlibrary loan, and just libraries having more exhaustive and more diverse collections, that you need somebody to show you the way, at least at first, or at least if your subject is somewhat obscure.
I don't want to go off on it too much, but I kind of feel like I should describe interlibrary loan, because I didn't even know about it until you really explained it to me. Like,
I'm the priestess of interlibrary loan.
Beautiful, beautiful, wonderful thing.
So far, I've been able to get every kind of weird book I've tried to get through interlibrary loan. So basically what happens is libraries all over the country participate, they communicate with each other, and you can check out a book from another library through your local library. I got Brad Warner's Hardcore Zen like that, which is a book that's on the top of Henry Rollins' reading list. I got Matt Wagner's Grendel.
I got Crispin Glover's, like, one of his art books that was limited to 200 copies from a New York art school.
But that's also one of those things you could never possibly experience online.
Yes, exactly, because there's something about, especially with art books, the physical artifact of the item. And some of these things simply do not exist on the internet. Like, there's reels and reels of microfilm and sheets and sheets and sheets of microfiche that have yet to be digitized, although that is a big kind of joint effort amongst a lot of libraries to take all that analog stuff and make it digital.
Just for example, when you're talking about the artifact of the thing itself, I have personally checked out with the aid of interlibrary loan, many, many oversized, huge, have to sit them on your lap to even handle them, graphic novels that just, again, the internet's no substitute for that. It's really not. When you have this huge thing, unless you're holding, I guess, a huge, massive screen in your lap, but it's just not the same thing. It doesn't have the weight to it. It doesn't have the same flow when you're reading it. It's actually a huge argument in the comic book reading community right now, with most people still very much falling on the side of wanting to hold the actual book in their hands. And that's an instance where the library is immensely helpful. There's many things that I've read, many things that I would consider as valid a work of literature or of fiction as anything without pictures, that I would have never been exposed to without the library.
Yes, and you should be able to look at these materials, especially if you're studying them academically or studying them for personal enrichment or to write a paper or what have you. You need to be able to have access to the actual physical items, so that way you can see the details in the drawings and things like that.
Well, a lot of people also just don't have the internet. They don't have money. I don't have enough money to get all the shit I want, all the books I want to read, all the comic books I want to read, all the movies I want to watch.
That's very, very true.
Yeah, and if I'm looking at something exhaustively and I need to look at a whole run of things and I'm doing it for an academic purpose, I shouldn't have to spend $500 for the academic exercise. I should be able to have access to those materials free, so that way I might study them. And then if I decide I love them and want to collect them, then I purchase the item.
There may be something to be said for the fact that people should go to the library just because it's intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, and it just by the nature of the thing, it exposes you to other topics.
Exactly. I always end up looking at stuff that I didn't think I would be looking at, and that I end up being really interested in some of it.
And that's another point for Rob's organizational system with his graphic novels, is that it leads to browsing. So when you go into this really attractively arranged, very easy to understand setting, you're more likely to pick something up, take it home, and learn.
I think that's as good of a jumping off point as any. Let's go on to the Rob Weiner interview.
Following the song On a Ship Under a Bus by The New Fugees.
Here with Rob Weiner. He is a librarian, a pop culture expert, and author, and according to herosandwich.net, a pop culture guru.
Actually, the Texas Tech University Press dubbed me that.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
that's
and people use it now, so I don't know how accurate it is, but I won't.
Well, we were definitely fooled.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
So Rob, you've co-edited and you've authored several articles and several books. Would you mind giving us a quick list of the, I guess, a bibliography as the great bibliographer?
Yeah, actually, I've done 3 books on the Grateful Dead. A bibliography documenting all of Marvel Comics. Books that they published, graphic novels, children's books from 1965 to 2005. I've co-edited 2 books on transgressive film, From the Art House to the Grindhouse and Cinema Inferno. a book on James Bond called The Films Are Not Enough. As far as The Grateful Dead, the latest one there is a collection of short stories, fiction, that I co-edited. And most recently, a book on Mystery Science Theater, which just came out, that I co-edited with librarian Shelley Barba, called In the Peanut Gallery with Mystery Science Theater. So a lot of things. Just published an article looking at the Holocaust in comic books in the Rutledge History of the Holocaust, as well as a book that just came out, which has an article called about the Batman 1966 movie, and the book is called 14 Miles Gotham City.
Oh,
and
you did a Batman book.
I'm in a Batman book, yeah.
A lot of the articles you read, you kept comparing, like, the pop, like, basically that Batman gets all the love. No love for Captain America or Spider-Man academically until you came along.
Well, yeah, that is true. They're actually as early as 1991, 1992, somebody did a really heavyweight academic study on Batman. There have been a lot of books previous to that, one called Batman Unmasked. There have been a number of books on Batman. Batman really sort of started in a lot of ways as far as looking at a specific character, the study in academia. So yeah, trying to do Spider-Man and Captain America. In fact, I'm working on a book right now, academic book on Spider-Man. I love Batman too. And what I argue in the book, 14 Miles, Gotham City, is that the 1966 Batman movie is a pivotal film in the history of sequential art, comic book-related movies. And in fact, in the summer of 1966, that was the movie to go see, was Batman the movie. And in this, you know, people don't realize this, but from 1951 to 1978, there were only three major comic book feature films in theaters.
No, I didn't know that at all. You know, you see all this old footage of, like, Superman TV serials and movies and stuff, and it does give you the impression that there was a lot of that stuff going on.
No. Now, there were a number of serials, but when we're talking just solid feature films, there were Superman versus the Mole Men, 1951, Batman the Movie, 1966, and Superman, 1978. So, that's it. I mean, there were some, like, pulp movies like Doc Savage and those kinds of things that are sort of, you know, Flash Gordon, that are genre films, but not always necessarily associated with comics and that. So really, you know, it surprises a lot of people when I say, well, you know, there were only these three movies. I mean, because now we're so used to superhero movies, they're coming out by the dozens. I'm amazed that there's even still an audience, to be quite honest with you. Well, no, I'm not, because of all the fanboys and people like me that are out there.
And probably most of our listeners.
Yeah. we'll go see them no matter how bad they are. You know, I'll even go see the sequel to Ghost Rider, which is horrible, you know.
I eventually watch all the superhero movies, but I only go to the theater for the really special ones.
I go to the theater for all of them. What do you think about Sucker Punch?
What do I think about Sucker Punch? I'll be interested to see. I believe, isn't it Zack Snyder?
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing the Avengers movie.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what he does with that. I just heard, and this really pisses me off, that Darren, however you say his name, just
Darren
pulled
Aronofsky.
Out. Yeah, just pulled out a Wolverine. I mean, that movie had the potential to really rock.
Yeah,
and he pulled out because apparently it was going to take him away from his family for a year. That is the reason he gave.
That selfish bastard.
You know, because the first Wolverine movie was less than great, and now we were for sure.
That's a pretty fair review.
It's less than good.
Even though it was more or less true to the mythos.
I actually enjoyed it, but I know what you mean. It was anticlimactic, and you know, when I grew up reading Wolverine and the X-Men, it was right at the very beginning of the Jim Lee stuff, and Gambit was a sex symbol. Like
Gambit.
Little girls like, were having their prepubescent crushes on Gambit.
Well, actually, Gambit helped usher in the age of the fangirl, believe it or not. That character single-handedly, in a lot of ways, brought a lot of young women to comics, which I think is cool.
Well,
I don't have
a
problem with
that.
That's
Gambit
great.
Tattoo.
No, actually, X-Men the Animated Series was the first comic book anything that I liked.
That was a pretty good
Gambit
series.
Yeah, it was very well written. It was very well done. Early
and Batman
90s.
Animated Series was the shit.
Yeah, the Batman Animated Series was fantastic and set the bar. But the X-Men was good. Iron Man was good. The Silver Surfer was good. Even the Mini Avengers series was pretty good. The Fantastic Four, not so much. Spider-Man was good. Hulk was good.
Are we talking about animated series?
Yeah, the Fox animated 1990s Marvel stuff. And then, of course, the one that set the standard, as you say, which is Batman. So, what else do you want to know? What else can we talk about?
I really personally wanted to ask you a lot about, because one of the things that you're, like, really, really respected for as an academic scholar is Captain America. And I wanted to kind of share with you my experience with Captain America and then ask you just basically to go off on a rant about Captain America and why you're so interested in it.
Okay.
I'm from Chile originally, and I grew up in the dictatorship, with the Pinochet dictatorship that was funded by the U.S. And you know, my parents were very political, so from a very early age, like, I had this, even though we were living in the United States, I had this idea as America as the big capitalist, imperialist pig. And then when I was, like, getting into comics at a young age, I would see Captain America and just his existence to be as someone from a country that had been so royally screwed by the U.S. the Cold War, like, seeing Captain America would piss me off. Though at some point somebody, like, pressured me into finally reading some, and I ended up liking him.
And of course you did.
And
because he's cool.
The most notable, like, for me, like, the Captain America mythos that I've really, you know, latched onto, especially with this background, is the Civil War version of Cap, where he's like, he stands for, like, the American idea, like, the Enlightenment idea that really gave birth to this country, where, like, personal freedom is considered to be central. Ever since then, I've kind of developed this thing where I see Captain America as America living out its potential through him.
Well, That's just it. Part of the reason that I liked Captain America and wanted to do the book on him was in part, actually, because my ex-wife and some of my friends were like, well, he's just a government stooge. How can you like Captain America? And to me, Captain America represents everything that's good about America, the American ideal. He does not represent partisan politics. He represents truth, justice, and freedom, and the quote-unquote American way, in the sense that what the Founding Fathers, you know, the ideal of America and what the flag of America represents or should represent, not what other people think it does, or what the Republicans or Democrats or Tea Party or whatever thinks America represents, but what America, the ideal of America. And to me, Captain America is different from, say, Superman, who many say, you know, is that he
is... Oh, Superman is he's an illegal immigrant, and he grew up on a farm. Superman is a Mexican.
Superman's kind of the Boy Scout. Don't get me wrong. I like Superman, too. I'm a huge fan. But to me, Cap, Superman is the government stooge. Cap is not.
Oh, don't make me defend the last son of Krypton.
We watched the
All-Star Superman is what we were watching last night.
Yeah, based off the Grant Morrison, and we were like, hail Superman.
Oh, how is it?
He's the true Christ.
I take it. It's pretty good.
The S stands for Space Jesus.
Yes. We were very devout to Space Jesus.
But I don't want to go off on a Superman tangent. We're here to talk about Captain America right now.
Yes.
Yeah, well, Captain America, you know, he was a, you know, historically a tool for propaganda, in the sense that, you know, the very first issue, he's slugging Hitler, And those early issues of Captain America were, and in a lot of comics back then during World War II, were used as morale boosters for soldiers. And you know, a lot of people don't realize that a lot of adults read those comics because they sent thousands of them to soldiers. And having the superheroes fight a real enemy, the Nazis, was kind of a positive thing. It boosted their morale. It made them feel good, even though it was fantasy. And so Captain America certainly grew out of kind of this sort of tool for America to fight the Nazis. And then in the 1950s, he became the Commie Smasher, which is very fascinating.
I'll have to read those.
Very few people have actually ever read the issues. They always portray him as this, you know, kind of...
I didn't learn about that until reading interviews with you to research for this interview.
Yeah.
That I didn't know that there was a Commie Smasher. I'm making the scare quotes
as
I speak. incarnation of Captain America.
And it's just fascinating to me. He wasn't exactly like this McCarthy-esque type character that a lot of people think he was, but more, you know, fighting. The communists were the enemy then, but Captain America was fighting real communists. He wasn't trying to, you know, do the witch hunts like Joseph McCarthy. And he's sometimes portrayed in the literature that way by people who've not read the comics.
Well, you know, even when you say him fighting the real communists, what comes to my mind is like playwrights, activists who were like making sure children got fed. I'm not a communist, but I definitely have... I could give you a list of some pretty awesome historical communists. What would Cap back then have thought of them? You know, the people who originally stood up to Hitler before we got involved, which was the East, you know, not East Germany back then, but Berlin was a hotbed for intellectual communists before Hitler took over. And those were the first people Hitler needed to get rid of because they were real competitors for power.
They were competitors for power. I would say that in terms of the quote-unquote real communists that Captain America would fight against are those that want to have their own, you know, the communism that is a dictatorship, the
sure.
communism that is that limits freedom, that limits freedom of speech, that limits freedom of ideas, freedom of religion and things like that. The evil communism.
Well,
if you will.
Like the communism that set the pattern for 1984.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I totally get you. I just wanted to clarify, or at least say some controversial pro-communist stuff. So when I go to Guantanamo Bay, they have a sound file.
Well, you're not going to catch me in that.
I'm not going to lure you into Guantanamo Bay.
No. Keep in mind, I also teach a class on the U.S. presidents and the history of the presidency, usually as it relates to film. So doing that, I've turned into somewhat of a patriot in a sense, and I in spite of all what you can say, America's history has a lot of bad, sure, you know, slavery, all that stuff, but there's a lot of good
no,
there
great.
Too.
No, I totally. I mean, even
you know?
You've got I think Diana and I both agree with you. About that there's an American idea that's totally awesome, and that, you know, that, and that as we grasp towards that idea, that's when the country really shows its best.
Yeah.
I think
Captain America as a character, comic book character, really represents that.
Sure.
Now, there was another character that Joe Simon and Jack Kirby created in the 1950s called the Fighting American. Because they were doing independent work then, and we're not doing for Marvel and DC. And he fought commies as well, including one called Hotsky Trotsky or something like that. It's really funny. So if you can get they've reprinted the Fighting American. I recommend that all listeners go check it out. It's hilarious. It's really great.
The coolest historical commies too were all American, in my opinion, with people like Emma Goldman and the Greenwich Village crowd of the late 19th century, early 20th century.
Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of not so much communists but socialists knew the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
American Constitution back in those days, much better than the people who were trying, you know, espousing it against them, they would quote the Constitution back at them, and it would be one of those weird sort of things that, well, so what if you know it, you're still a socialist, so we're not going to listen to you. The problem I see with isms in general is the limitation of the American ideal, and that's where, you know, Captain America is not a government stooge, as you say, with Civil War. He's representing personal liberty and freedom and the right of the individual to choose, you know, the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness, you know, the ideals, quote unquote, of the American fathers. I will say that I do get tired of people slagging on Washington and Jefferson or John Adams or for whatever reason, because I do think they were great men. You can't always have a 21st century political correctness perspective on history. It doesn't always work that way.
Well, you know, that would be, if you taking that same kind of mentality, you have to ignore all the contributions from the classical philosophers. Because of all the slavery and screwed up stuff that was going on. Yeah, humanity. I think people need to understand that humanity is actually getting smarter as time progresses.
I don't know about that, but
well, at least as far as not having slaves and stuff.
Oh yeah. although you know, apparently slavery still exists in the world. Which is a terrible thing.
And in the developing world especially. Go ahead, Diana.
Okay, so I would hop in kind of. While we're still talking about Captain America, at least tangentially, I wanted to ask you how you feel, like, how do you reconcile an archetypal character that's supposed to manifest certain ideas, and yet this character gets written by numerous people over time? So how do you, as an academic, like, trace that? I mean, isn't that kind of what you're looking at? Is like kind of the entire history of Captain America.
Well, yeah, and you've got the Kirby and Simon era, the Stan Lee eras, the Stan Lee and Kirby eras, the J.M. DeMatteis eras, the Steve Englehart eras, the Michael Bendis era.
Bendis, that's my Captain America right there.
You know, Mark Grunewald, Mark Waid, you know, lots of thousands of people have contributed, just like with any comic character, whether it's Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, whatever, to their historical legacy. And what one, you know, writer does, another undoes, and so it's. And yet, to me, Captain America, there's something about the core value of the American ideal and what it should be that resonates and continues with the character, regardless of who is writing him or who's doing it. And so, you know, and even the modern, you know, Ed Brubaker with the death of Captain America and his revival, you know, it's a pretty darn good yarn. And ultimately, what boils down to the whole fanboy, fangirl thing, superheroes, whatever, is, are you telling a good story with the character? And, you know, I'm not one who thinks that every single thing that Grant Morrison and Alan Moore touches is gold. There are some things that
No,
I think,
get out.
There are some things that, I personally think that Morrison's run on the new X-Men sucks rocks, you know. But his run on new Superman, or All-Star Superman, is great. And certainly the Invisibles and some of these other things that he's done. And, you know, I'm not... Not everything Bendis touches is gold, you know. On the other hand, I love Roy Thomas, and I've rarely read anything that I don't like that Roy Thomas has written, or Tom DeFalco. So, you know.
Well, I think sometimes you as a reader, you connect with a certain mentality of the writer. I haven't read, we're talking about Grant Morrison writing the X-Men. I didn't even know Grant Morrison was writing the X-Men. But I can guess right now... that Grant Morrison's, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and we could test my psychic connection with Grant Morrison. But I'm guessing that there's probably like the character, it's probably heavily driven by the characters having some kind of transformative, like, self-analysis.
Oh, yeah.
And there might be some mystical Deepak Chopra quantum.
Yeah, there is. And actually, actually, what I didn't like about Morrison's run on the X-Men is that he basically created one of the coolest X-Men characters in the last 25 years, a character called Zorn, who's exactly that thing. And then Zorn turns into this Magneto-type clone where he thinks he's Magneto and wrecks the X-Men. That was just stupid. I'm sorry. Fanboys, you can be upset at me for saying that, but what he creates this great character and then ruins him. And in some ways, I guess that is very Morrison-esque. So I'll recant my statement saying that it's stupid. It does fall within the way Morrison writes, and he to his credit, Morrison, does what he wants and writes the characters the way he wants. I just didn't like. It seemed like a cop out to me. I don't know. I like Zorn so much.
I can appreciate the art. If you turn anyone into Magneto and you're writing the X-Men, you're being lazy. I will grant that.
Okay.
unless you're writing Magneto and your whole, like, Magneto, like, to me, is like Captain America or Superman, and he's one of these icon, like I would go gaga. So, and you're gonna probably tell me that it already exists. If somebody wrote a big academic like collection like you've done for Cap, and you're working on for Spider-Man on Magneto.
There are a couple of articles about Magneto in some collections.
I had a punk band that I wrote a song called Asteroid M.
Oh, yeah.
And my drummer vetoed it because he said it was too Nazi. Even though it was just me writing, like, from Magneto's perspective. I didn't write any fucked up, like, white power stuff.
Which is so ironic because Magneto's Jewish, you know?
But I think that's supposed to be part of the thing that makes him so interesting is that he lived through the Final Solution, and then that he sees that so many times throughout his development as what must be done by the mutants to humanity.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny we talk about Magneto because oftentimes when I go and lecture to classes about comics or popular culture or whatever, I'm often asked what hero I would be. And I tell them I don't think I would be a hero. The villains are always more interesting, and villains are always more complex. Mm-hmm. Your hero is only as good as your villain. And Magneto is not completely evil. He does evil things, but...
No, there's times when he's truly heroic. And
there's
I think
times
the,
when he's truly when, heroic,
and the
exactly.
contrast, to me, as a lifelong X-Men reader, I started reading X-Men when I was 11 years old by shoplifting them from a local grocery store.
That's terrible. Don't admit that.
Well, I've definitely paid for hundreds of copies of the X-Men since.
But to me, Magneto's power is the ultimate. I can't think of any greater power than being able to manipulate metal because it's even in your body.
Yeah.
You know, and he can fly doing that. You can do anything. And so I would be Magneto. That would be the character that I would choose and the powers that I would choose to have
if I could.
Who would you be, Diana?
Jean Grey.
That's funny that you both pick an X-Men.
I thought we were just picking X-Men.
No, any superhero. Who would you be? This will be fun.
Villain. I really like Poison Ivy a lot.
Oh, that's a cool one.
That is a cool one.
Oh, there's Bastet.
Yes.
And you?
I really, really love, like, the Grendel mythos by Matt Wagner.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I like it is I think it's Devil Indeed where the Asian, like theater director becomes a Grendel. I might have my Grendel chronology wrong, but the whole story in Grendel, for those who've never read it, Matt Wagner is basically, and I feel like Grant Morrison is ripping this off a little bit with Return of Bruce Wayne, Grendel is like the devil, but he's just a meme, he's just a concept, and humans get infected with this concept, and
sounds like the Brood.
Well, that might be, Matt Wagner may have taken his cue from that. The Brood was around in the early 80s, mid-80s.
The 70s, so, yeah.
Grendel didn't come out till the mid to late 80s. But the Grendels, like, you find the Grendels when they become Grendel, and Grendel's a bad guy, for sure. their inner ruthlessness comes out, like, pouring out. So, like, even if you're, like, this weak, mild-mannered person, when the Grendel meme takes over you, you become the most terrifying being in the universe, and you will be 100% lethal until someone kills you. And the only time people get confused and think Grendel's heroic is because occasionally Matt Wagner will create something worse than Grendel to share the stage, and Grendel will just kill it because it's in its way. And so, like, if I had to, I would take any Grendel. The ideal one is Grendel Prime because he's the solar battery cyborg that kicks everyone's ass. But I would even take the weak, like, theater director Grendel who, like, all he did was run around with a box cutter and be ridden with anxiety. Worthwhile for this podcast to talk about your academic work with the Grateful Dead.
Well, we don't have enough time to discuss everything. That's a huge
okay, well,
subject.
Just let me ask you this. So, totally simple question, but it's probably not. Why academically pursue the Grateful Dead?
A number of reasons. First of all, and speaking of Captain America, the Grateful Dead are America's greatest band. I'm just going to say that. They are the ultimate American band, and they stand for everything that America should stand
Diana
for.
Diana and I just lost 50 Mohawk points just by standing next to you.
Because
the correct answer was Black Flag.
No, actually, Black Flag were all Grateful Dead fans anyway.
Snapped them all.
Yeah, Greg Ginn and Henry Rollins. In fact, I actually met Henry Rollins. I was going to Dead shows at the same time I was going to see Black Flag here in Lubbock. There are three legendary shows. Black Flag played here twice. Rollins did a poetry thing, and I actually sat down and talked to Rollins about seeing the Dead. And everything. He actually did a cover of the Grateful Dead's Franklin's Tower on the Stolen Roses
album. I think
album.
You outing Black Flag as Grateful Dead fans might have just made this a historic episode.
there was an article in Rolling Stone magazine. The Grateful, you know, I'll tell you, the Minutemen were Dead fans, Sonic Youth are Dead fans. The Grateful Dead has an uncoolness factor because of the negativity surrounding the fans, but the band themselves are so, their attitude is punk rock. I'm sorry, it's the do it yourself, personal freedom, on your own terms. They did it before anybody else did, practically, and just became successful. Now the fans, you know, that's what a lot of people don't like about them. And in fact, in my book is no, but I've been to shows accepting the Dead but rejecting the Deadheads. There's an article that looks at that in my book Perspectives on the Grateful Dead, which was the very first academic volume on the Dead. But getting back to your question, okay, what I mean by saying they're America's greatest band and probably the greatest live band that ever existed is that the Grateful Dead represent, like Captain America, the American ideal of personal freedom, following your bliss, the whole Joseph Campbell kind of thing. Don't hurt other people. Don't step on other people's trips. But, you know, within reason. And everything about the Dead speaks to classic American liberalism, not partisan politics, but American liberalism in the Jeffersonian, type sense. And the band, if you look at what they, you know, their music, I mean, it comes from American folk, it comes from blues, it comes from jazz, it comes from avant-garde John Cage, a modern classical weirdness. It comes from traditional rock and roll, you know, Buddy Holly, Bill Haley, that kind of stuff. They covered the Beatles, they covered the Stones, that world music aspect. In many ways, regardless of what you think, the Grateful Dead really are kind of the ultimate band when it comes to music, in the sense that their influence is that expansive, probably more than any other band in the world.
Grateful Dead versus Beatles.
Well, the Beatles are far more important than the Grateful Dead on the historical scene. The Beatles changed the world. The Grateful Dead were primarily an American phenomenon. The Beatles were worldwide. Everyone's influenced by the Beatles, not, you know, the Grateful Dead have influenced culture in a much different way. In addition to the Deadheads, and you're asking, why are they worth studying in academia? Well, the whole sociological phenomenon of the Deadheads and again, this speaks to Americanism too, who would, you know, follow the band around. Well, it's kind of like the gypsies or the following the circuses around in the late 1800s, you know. The Dead were they were really the last sort of circus you could kind of follow around, you know. I mean, some people, okay, Fish, okay. And see, I don't like Fish. And that's going to piss some people off my saying that, but Fish doesn't do it for me.
No,
Widespread
we don't ever
panic
piss anybody
doesn't...
off on the Mindcore podcast.
No, we don't say anything controversial or unsubstantiated.
I don't like jam bands, to be quite honest with you. I love the Dead and all the offshoot bands, but I don't like the traditional jam band scene. I'm actually more of a you know, Beatles, Pink Floyd, Stones, Zeppelin kind of guy.
Okay, let me ask you this, and this is just my nerdy question for my benefit. If Texas hadn't have been so cruel and horrible to Rocky Erickson, do you think 13th floor elevators would have been that?
No.
No?
I don't. But however, the interesting thing about the 13th floor elevators, and this, what I'm about to say is going to tick some people off, but I'm sorry, Sgt. Pepper's was not the first psychedelic album. It's probably the single most influential album ever made. I'll give you that. But the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators came out in 1966, not 1967, which is when the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's, came out. Now, the odd thing is that the elevators, in order to make it, had to go to San Francisco. I mean, they're a Texas band, but you know, they're it's kind of like Steve Miller. You know, he was like in Dallas, but his Steve Miller band was known as San Francisco. And really, the greatest flowering in American music, I mean, the Dead came out of that. Jefferson Airplane was the San Francisco scene. Now, I know we had Seattle in the 90s. I know that we had the Motown Detroit thing as well.
Now, Texas gets neglected in musical history.
Not so much anymore.
I've never heard 13th Floor Elevator, but y'all's conversation makes me think of another similar thing that I do know a lot about, which is the Dicks. The Dicks were making hardcore punk rock in the 60s.
Yeah.
And they're from Texas.
Yeah. Well, and that's like the Sonics in Seattle in 1964. You listen to some of that early Sonic stuff, and you're like, oh, that's where Nirvana came from, huh? That's where Mother Love Bone came from. And the Dicks were, you know, the same way. And that's just it. You know, there's always an influence that is unknown that really the people in the know kind of know about, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, the person who releases the Dicks now is Jello Biafra, who made his rise in the 70s.
Yeah.
Right. So that kind of implies, and Jello is kind of a librarian-type personality. He has a whole book about his record collection, in which he has a Marcel Marceau record that he says is just 40 minutes of silence and applause. I'm like, that's the most librarian behavior.
Well, Jello is fascinating, and the Dead Kennedys, mm-hmm, are fascinating. Getting back to that, you know, I never saw any conflict when I was in my 20s going to see the Dead and going to the punk rock shows like Black Flag. You know, the Minutemen played one of their last gigs here in Lubbock. Husker Du, I think, actually played their last gig here in Lubbock. Saw the Lords of the New Church with Stib Bators, who, of course, founded the Dead Boys. Somewhere there's somebody should write a paper about the punk rock sort of attitude within the Grateful Dead. I'm not the one to do it, even though I advocate it.
You know, well, hopefully we'll help deliver that meme for you.
Yeah. if someone wants to interview me for doing their academic paper, they could that would be fun.
We're gonna put links and all kinds of stuff.
I've been thinking the whole time we've been doing this interview. This is gonna be the most links intensive.
let's talk about the transgressive film books, because I know that you are interested in that.
I don't even know anything about that, so I will represent the part of the audience that's totally in the dark.
Okay, so you've written it's two books like in a series about transgressive.
What is transgressive film?
I'll let Rob do that.
Transgressive film is anything that is in your face and bucks the system in some way.
So
anything
would Hodorowski count? That's my favorite
director. Yes, absolutely.
Oh yeah, you mean like Holy Mountain and El Topo, of course. Oddly enough,
I feel like I'm being sexually abused when I watch those movies.
Yeah, but it doesn't. The thing that I want to emphasize, and I do see what you're saying. Although to me, Holy Mountain is just like it's like going into another world.
Oh, I mean, it's my favorite movie.
About Santa Sangria? I mean, that's an amazing
film. I just saw that
like
a week ago, and it definitely molested my inner child. Well, what you
really need to sit and watch, there are two film directors you need to watch: Jean Cocteau's Orphic trilogy,
okay,
and then watch all the films, the two volumes of Kenneth Anger.
I've never seen Kenneth Anger, but I've heard him cited so many times.
Oh my gosh, Kenneth Anger is a god, literally, as far as filmmaking. To me, he's so wonderful and fantastic. I've had the most uplifting experiences watching his movies. They're just amazing. And I went to a screening of one of his films one time, and it's the only time. And in addition to seeing thousands of shows, I've seen literally thousands of movies. The only time I've ever been where an audience stood up and clapped after one of his movies. I've never seen that in a movie theater before.
Not me either.
But one of the things, getting back to transgressive film, I want to point out is that that doesn't necessarily mean sex, drugs, violence, okay? One of the single most transgressive movies ever made was a movie you would be interested in called Salt of the Earth, which was called a communist film, even though it wasn't a communist film, but one of the people accused, Herbert Biberman, who actually went to jail for, you know, that whole bit, made the film. The FBI were following the filmmakers, but its message is people should treat each other decently. Women have rights. Races can get along, and that kind of thing. So, and when you look at the history of that film, it's one of the most persecuted movies ever made, and in my view, one of the single most transgressive films. So, but what our volumes look at, From the Art House to the Grindhouse and Cinema Inferno, co-edited with John Klein, who is a PhD student in American Studies at University of Texas, they grew out of, I started this area at the Southwestern Popular Culture Association, as well as starting the Grateful Dead area, which is huge now. I mean, academics from all over the world, that is the place to come and to present about the Grateful Dead, and I started it, so...
were popular culture academic conventions.
Oh yes. Yeah.
My one visit to a Comic-Con was probably what most Muslims experience in the Hajj. And I would totally love, like, is the general public welcome at these academic conventions?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they can come and sit in on the sessions. Stuff is very weighty and, you know, academic, you know, phrased in that way. But
there's a lot of the lay public that's weighty and academic just for fun, and that's what our podcast promotes.
But, you know, I started this, just on a whim, this transgressive cinema thing. And the first time we did it, only two people came, one of which was my co-editor, John Klein. But, and it almost died a quick death because the director of the association was like, nobody came. And I said, well, give us one more chance, you know, because it was one of the most well-attended sessions. There was like 50 people in the room. I mean, it was huge, even though there were just two people presenting. So now it's grown, you know, and John and I co-edited the volume. We co-chair the area. You know, it's grown to be pretty weighty, and people come and present on everything from, You know, we've got somebody presenting on Dark Shadows, the vampire
sit through probably 12 hours of lectures on Dark Shadows without a second thought. So, and then have questions afterwards about True Blood and and being human.
I mean, everything from the transgression in cinema covers a really wide range, from art cinema to pornography to horror cinema to exploitation cinema. It just covers the gamut, and our books look at the whole sort of history of transgressive cinema. We've got articles about the Italian films of like Argento and Fulci, articles about Marvin Van Peebles, the blaxploitation director. There are articles about Nazi cinema, propaganda cinema, articles about Christian scare feature films, exploitation cinema, like If Horses Tire, What Will Footmen Wear, or something like that. I'm saying it wrong, but Estes Perkel and Ron Armand, a series of films that they made in the early 70s. Just a huge range of material related to the history of cinema, and John and I are very proud of the two books.
And I think it's so, I don't know, personally, I think looking at transgressive cinema is, like, really important and really vital. Like, I agree with that on the comics, too, because, comics are unique in that you are taking these archetypal characters that are constantly getting reinvented, and it's just such a great snapshot of literature, of art, of whatever's going on at that particular time through the filter of whoever's writing it. But with transgressive cinema, I think nothing says more about a culture, so quickly, so like in an hour and a half, 2 hours, you get social norms, you get, cultural taboos, you get all these things packed into one film, and they usually end up being like, really insightful. I love, my thing is Japanese horror. I love transgressive Japanese horror. I can watch it all day. I could sit for 12 hours a fucking panel, like, and have questions.
Yeah. There are some pretty weighty Japanese movies. I mean, the Guinea Pig series, that it's notorious. Movies like Splatter, a.k.a. Naked Blood, Mike's films, Audition, Dead or Alive trilogy.
I mean, you can catch
Itchy the Killer.
From what little I've seen, it's very obvious in this stuff, and also in manga, I'm thinking like of La Blue Girl and stuff like that, the Japanese attitudes about sex, and even like a lot of stuff that would be very taboo in the U.S., they're totally comfortable with in Japan.
Well, but see, in Japanese culture, the whole thing about comics, comics went through a period, and we're getting close to being beyond that now, but where it was considered just trash and subpar, not anything. And in Japanese culture, adults were growing up reading comics. It's what you do. They're everywhere.
Everybody reads manga.
Yeah, everybody reads manga, or goes to see anime. And there are some really, one could argue watching something like Ghost in the Shell or Akira, or reading Akira, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I've actually read the original of Epic Comics, Marvel Comics, 35-volume Akira from, doing it that way. I'd say that makes my street cred somewhat. So what else?
Well, and I see transgressive theater mainstreaming. I think Black Swan, you can argue, is a transgressive film.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a beautiful film. And I was, like, stuck in movie land for a whole hour after I watched it. I was like, but that was a popular movie and, starred Natalie Portman.
Well, we were talking about Aronofsky earlier.
Yeah, probably one of the most popular actresses around.
Yeah, she's in everything now. She's huge.
Yeah, and she's...
Well, even V for Vendetta.
Yeah. Oh, I love V for Vendetta.
But does V for Vendetta count? Let's pick on the Wachowski brothers a little bit. V for Vendetta, the comic book, to me is definitely a very radical comic book.
Yeah, and it's totally, transgressive in its own way.
But how about the movie, which was a very mainstream action flick that, you know, NASCAR dads were at V for Vendetta going, yeah, get them fuckers!
the thing about it is that the word transgressive can be a catch-all phrase for just about anything you want to make it. That's what's so great about it. And that's why I'm always harping on the fact that it's more than, you know, sex and violence. It could be, hey, let's treat each other decently. You know, women have rights. Natalie Portman's cutting herself. Those kinds of things. You know, it can cover a very wide range kind of catch-all phrase for anything you want it to be, and that's the beauty of it. Anything that one person, you know, might think offensive could be transgressive in some way. You know, even you know, something like Bugs Bunny has its transgressive elements.
Oh, that's or the, you know, anyone who's seen the Crumb movie knows that.
Or the Road Runner, you know, always beating up on Wile E. Coyote.
It's very sadistic. I
mean, or the Three Stooges. I mean, you can phrase it in such a way that it makes it work, and that's why it's such a expansive kind of area of film studies now.
Well, to me, you know, a lot of people would argue, you know, seeing scenes of depravity, seeing scenes of extreme violence, seeing scenes of rape, child molestation, murder, that's bad for your brain. It's not good for your psychology, you know. But for me personally, I find something extremely purifying about surviving, you know, a 2-hour, getting through Happiness. I don't like that movie, but I can get through it. I can watch Happiness, you know, and... yes, it makes me feel yucky, and I feel like my inner child was raped at the end of it. I'm like, oh, I've been touched. I hate it. But to me, there's something very cathartic, something purifying about being able to, like, be witness to this ugliness.
Well, doesn't that go back to Aristotle? Isn't that Aristotle, like, the first one who, like, pontificated that we must go to the theater and see horrible things for catharsis?
Well, and you know, we could do, you know, an 8-hour show just on that, you know, the Grand Guignol.
And maybe we will.
In France, you know. all the beheadings and rapes and things that went on in that theater, you know, the theater of horrors, the Grand Guignol. Are you familiar with that?
No,
but you definitely sold it.
Yeah, the 19...
I don't know, but I want to tattoo.
Vive la France.
Yeah, well, I could go on and on and on about that, but that was the original theater that kind of inspired some of these you know, horror. But what was my point? Oh yeah, I felt that way walking out of Hostel, the first one.
Oh yeah,
I felt ugly. I felt dirty, but it also made me realize that I was alive. You know, that I was human. And I think there's a big difference. And this is, you know, Boris Karloff talked about this. The great horror actor, between horror and terror. Okay, Hostel is a horrifying movie. It's not particularly scary. You know, Aliens is the scariest movie I've ever seen, being on the edge of my seat, you know. That's considered to be a science fiction film, not so much a horror movie. Horror, you can be horrified, you feel horror. Terror is something completely different, and suspense in film going. And so I think it's important to make those kinds of distinctions when we're talking about these things, because you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so like Scream would be a terror movie because it's all about surprising you and startling you.
Yeah.
But yeah, something like any
Audition is
movie.
Horrifying.
Yes, yeah. You know, and it's Audition is such a brilliant movie. Oh my God.
And yet I will tell you this much, there's a scene in Audition that, even though I know it's coming, still scares the living bejesus out of me.
Yeah. There's a bunch of nothing. Yeah. He does such a good job of, like, lulling you in, and you're like, how is this a horror movie? This is just a nice little story. It's a little creepy. That's fine. Whatever.
It's not a little creepy. It's way creepy.
And then it's like, boom! And it gets me every single time, even though I've seen that movie 10 times.
Ring.
Yeah.
that's what does. And I've never seen Ringu, which is probably going to be even more hardcore.
Ringu is fantastic.
I've just seen the American adaptation.
The American adaptation is not bad,
but it scares the hell out of me.
Actually, the first one is very good. Unfortunately, the second one is not so good, even though it was directed by the original Ringu director, which is crazy.
You wrote a book about how to catalog comic books in libraries.
Yeah, I did, one of the books that we haven't talked about was a book on comics in libraries.
Well, my number one Rob Weiner anecdote, and the reason you will always be like in very high esteem in my mind, is because I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, which is, you know, I will probably eventually write a book about growing up in Lubbock, Texas, because it's so surreal and weird. And it's a very conservative, very religious, and very kind of like Dust Bowl kind of place. And I've been going to the library here my whole life, and suddenly at one point all these wonderful comic books and graphic novels started appearing seemingly out of nowhere in vast quantities.
Yeah.
And I've been
I did that.
Yeah. And I had to
I'm guilty.
Eventually I found out that you were the one, and I immediately started going up to you every time I went to the library and asking recommendations and BSing with you, and I read a lot of great stuff.
I remember.
And to me that's like some like Thomas Jefferson shit you did. Like,
oddly enough, I can take credit for helping build one of the biggest and most expansive graphic novel collections for a public library. I haven't done that since I've been to Texas Tech, although we do have a much stronger comic book sequential art academic presence in the collection, which I was hired in part to do, bring a popular culture sort of aspect to the library. But, you know, as the art, music, film librarian. But, that's something I'm really proud of. And it's I can't even tell you how it happened. It just kind of happened. I decided one day, why don't we have books about Spider-Man in the library? And I went to the director and said, can I start ordering these things? And she said, sure. And then I said, can I have more money? Can I spend more money? She said, well, do they circulate? Well, here are the results. And then I started writing about it. I developed a cataloging system, mm-hmm. an in-house kind of cataloging system, which is very controversial, especially the whole separating Marvel and DC. But as a fan, boy or girl, you understand why that works.
And which is also what's done at, if you go to Barnes & Noble right now and look at their trade paperback section, which is what the yuppies who are now getting into comics call them.
Which is okay, as long as they're getting into it.
No, I want everybody. I wish I could, there needs to be a front page story with Barack Obama reading his favorite comic. I'm sure he has one.
Actually, he does. Spider-Man is one of his favorites. And Conan.
Oh, I didn't know he was a Conan fan. Yeah, That's very true to my heart.
And in fact, there is a Barack the Barbarian comic that's... I haven't read it, but that's sort of a satire because Obama was a big Conan fan.
I'm definitely going to have to hunt that down. But that's what they do at Barnes & Noble. So you know what your reasoning that you're describing is also the market reasoning.
Well, they didn't used to do that at Barnes & Noble when they first started getting graphic novels, because I spent a lot of the library's money going to Barnes & Noble and buying graphic novels.
So you're just revolutionizing it all over the place.
Yeah, now, kind of indirectly.
No, it's a beautiful system because, you know, I'm not a comic expert, but I know what I want, and I don't want to dig forever, you know? And I don't want to have to... I want to be able to browse. And it is such a browsable system that I wish there was a way to do it for all books. But it's intuitive with the comic books because, you know, it's by company, it's by genre, it's by character. So if I want to follow Wolverine around, I don't have to go all over the damn library.
No.
It's all there in front of me. And it's then I can make a choice.
Right by Doctor Strange.
Yes. And Doctor Strange is...
The beauty of that is that also, too, is that we would put books about Spider-Man, like the academic collection, mm-hmm. or a book about the Spider-Man movie, with the Spider-Man graphic novels, rather than in the regular stacks, because
that's where it's going to circulate. People who are interested in Spider-Man, you know, you want, and there is something to be said. Putting all the Star Wars books together, all the Star Trek books, doing that with some of this genre stuff makes a whole lot of sense, because then it's all right there. I wish more libraries could do that. It's much more difficult in the academic setting as opposed to the public library setting to be able to do that, but not impossible. I mean, we've got the DVDs separated. We've got a popular reading area with a lot of interesting things. So, you know, but you were asking about academic librarianship. More and more, you're finding academic librarians presenting on and researching their kind of subject areas going beyond the library science stuff. Like at a recent conference I attended, Film and History, I was not the only academic librarian there. There were three others, and we all found each other. It was like we had this librarian radar that was, you know, it was weird. But, you know, there were some that were presenting, you know, there were music librarians, and they were presenting on music and film. I presented on the Spider-Man movies and romance. You know, it just, more and more, you're finding the, academic librarians branching out. And with the demands of the academic rigor and the idea that, you know, we need to be scholars in the same sense
and peer
that
review,
the peer review and all that stuff, they're having to, you know, kind of go beyond just librarianship to get a name for themselves and
but I see the work. Connection with that between what you do very clearly and like just being a reader. And that, like, and I wish there was more, which is one of the reasons we're having you on the podcast. I wish there was more awareness about all the work that goes into that kind of stuff, into cataloging all these things that we love. I mean, I'm really nerdy, and I'm into philosophy, and I'm into all kinds of highbrow stuff, but I got introduced to all of it through popular culture delivery, like comic books or horror movies.
Yeah.
You know, like, I probably started reading philosophy because a philosopher would get quoted in a comic book or something. We haven't talked about role-play games at all, but I was talking to my buddy the other day that I started listening to goth music, which is one of my favorite genres, because I would go find the music that was getting quoted in the White Wolf games.
You mean like
minus 50 Mohawk
like Roz points. Williams and the Bahas,
yeah, all that.
That's, Christian Death,
and I was like the like one of like three goths in Lubbock.
Because, I was the other one.
Because I was using this pop culture stuff as a library, so to see that, to see it actually going into the library and to see that it's flourishing in the academy makes me want to inform the regular public, especially since now we have things like the internet and YouTube and Reddit and all these wonderful ways that anybody can become hyper informed. At will.
Thank you, Rob and Diana. That was a great conversation. And now we're done with the Mindcore podcast, and your outro is going to be Icarus by the band Mankind is Obsolete.
Destruction.